what we had.
Let's see.
Is something special.
On the 25th, this month is it. You get tune like them, yeah.
You, I'll give my all and all.
Check out the Beats Fest this Sunday, you know what I'm saying?
Good things come to
you. Once enough respect to the promoter, you know what I'm
saying? Your love was worth the wait. My life is complete. Now I found you. No need to search no more.
That's why I'm reaching out to my beautiful wife.
www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a man, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia, and I'm your host for today's show. Today we'll be airing audio from the archives. This is an interview with Diana Block that we did in August 2016. Diana is the author of two books, a memoir called Arm the Spirit, and a novel called Clandestine Occupations. She is part of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, an organization dedicated to organizing with and advocacy for former and current prisoners in the women's prison system in California. Diana also spent about 10 years underground between the mid-1980s and 1990s as part of a white solidarity formation that was supporting mostly the Puerto Rican independence movement. When she and her comrades resurfaced in the mid-90s, two members of her formation went to prison for between 2 to 5 years as part of their resurfacing deal. The charges were related to an attempted liberation of political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera, who had his sentence commuted by Barack Obama in 2017 and is living back in Puerto Rico. Anyways, without further ado, here is Diana Block. Can you start by telling us a bit of your story? How did you get involved in the early organizing that you were doing? And is there a point at which you realized your worldview had changed in some fundamental way?
I came of age in the 60s and 70s, so of course there was a lot going on that was life-changing in general, but as with everybody, there's always a particular entry point, and mine really came through the women's movement. I was really involved in racial justice type of activities and other types of support work, but I don't think I really kind of understood the way in which those issues were interconnected with myself. And so I became involved as a feminist. And somehow that opened my consciousness. I began to see the world through a political lens rather than just being different isolated or problematic issues. So that was my first, I would say, big worldview shift. And then the second one had to do with when I started, I moved from New York to California, and very early on I got involved with other women who were doing solidarity work with women in Vietnam. And that really was a big shift for me as well, because at that point I began to understand some of the American chauvinist ways in which the U.S. feminist movement was operating, and I began to really understand the issue of women's liberation in an international context, which was very important in terms of challenging a lot of types of white supremacist and U.S.-centric notions of what feminism was about. And then I would say the third major shift was when I became involved and part of the founding of the Prairie Fire Organizing Committee, which was a radical organization founded in 1975. It was primarily a white organization that was saw itself as acting in solidarity with Third World Liberation Movement. Becoming involved with that, I really took a step into dedicating my political work and my life to revolutionary anti-imperialism is the way we termed it at the time. And I really began seeing my political work in relationship to national liberation movements around the world, and also understanding at that point that the ways in which revolution was made wasn't just about public activity, but could very justifiably involve types of underground activity as well, as was being led by people all around the world, in Vietnam and Cuba and Nicaragua and all through Southern Africa. Those were all examples at the time. So that also shifted my understanding of sort of what my responsibilities, at least in that era, were as a white anti-imperialist feminist woman.
So it sounds like you traveled through a bunch of different maybe ideologies, maybe movements, depending on how you want to think about them. And I think because this is the Prison Radio Show, we're going to end up trying to talk about how prisoner justice or prisoner support or political prisoner support relates to all of that kind of stuff. So do you want to talk a little bit about how you got involved in prisoner justice or prisoner support or political prisoner support, and also what you call it when you do that kind of work and why you call it that?
How I started in the 70s is, you know, somewhat different than now, or you know, evolved in different ways. So just to be clear, in the 70s, I was not, my political work was not centered on prison justice work. I mean, if that was the advantage at that point in time of being part of a political organization, it did a lot of different types of work, and therefore different people did different, you know, dedicated themselves to different aspects. However, so as part of Prairie Fire, I was very active in general solidarity with prisoners, particularly prisoners at San Quentin. One of the very long-time political prisoners whom I think your listeners are familiar with was Julio Montaquin, and he had been arrested in 1971, and he was at San Quentin in the latter part of the 70s. And he was one of a collective that put out a newspaper called Arm the Spirit. And Prairie Fire, the organization I was part of, was the support network on the outside for publishing that that newspaper. And so I was definitely, I didn't myself do the layout, but I was part of distribution and of studying the articles that were written in Arm the Spirit. And I did do some visiting at San Quentin, although not all the time. I also did some visiting in that in the 70s of the women's prison in Southern California, CIW, and that came about actually through the work I was part of around women in Vietnam, because we had a slideshow and a presentation, and we went into the prison, which at that time, no longer would that be possible, but at that time was open to groups coming in with pretty radical politics and making presentations. And so we were able to go into the women's prison and make a presentation about the struggle in Vietnam and how women were winning their liberation as part of that. So that was my early relationship to prison solidarity work. And in terms of what to call it, I mean, I guess I would call it prisoner solidarity work, but nowadays it's part of a more of a general abolitionist framework of wanting to kind of abolish the prison industrial complex altogether as we know it.
So my next question is, do you think about your decision to go underground as a decision to support prisoners? And if so, why?
I wouldn't say that that's how we primarily saw our decision to go underground. We saw the decision to go underground as part of solidarity with the Puerto Rican independence movement, the Black liberation movement, Native movement, with the movements as a whole. Now, at the same time, we knew, I mean, those movements had been under serious attack. Many people had been imprisoned as a result of COINTELPRO and other types of related attacks. And we understood that part of the aspect of solidarity was in relationship to supporting prisoners, because they were the freedom fighters in those liberation movements. So definitely our decision was connected, or we saw work in connection, but it wasn't that wasn't the way we framed it per se. However, also at that time, some of the most leading political actions that were being undertaken by clandestine groups were in relationship to prisoners. So in 1979, a couple of years before I went underground, Assata Shakur was liberated from prison. And shortly before Assata was liberated, Guillermo Morales, who was a freedom fighter in the Puerto Rican independence movement, was liberated. I mean, he liberated himself, but then he had help afterwards from prison, from Bellevue in New York City. So, Bellevue Hospital. So, clearly, those were actions that were very significant and kind of raised the possibilities of what type of solidarity and support work a group that was underground could undertake. So those examples were definitely in our consciousness when we went underground. So I don't know. I guess it's a yes and no answer. Definitely prison solidarity was very linked to our purpose in going underground, but the overall definition was more about the liberation movement as a whole.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We are airing an interview from the archives today. This interview is with feminist and revolutionary Diana Block, and it was recorded in August 2016. In this next section of the interview, Diana talks more about her time underground as part of a formation of white revolutionaries acting in solidarity with national liberation struggles.
In Arm the Spirit, which is your memoir, you talk about watching America's Most Wanted, like right from when the show started, every Saturday night. And you talk about worrying that they would run a story on the show about you and your comrades who were underground with you. And you were also underground during a time of big increases in the prison population in the U.S. I haven't exactly looked up the numbers, but I know between the 80s and 90s, the prison population in the U.S. skyrocketed. And I was wondering if you have insights or thoughts about how ideas around crime and punishment were changing during this time period.
I mean, that it was a period of a very, very dramatic change. And of course, when we were living through it, we could see aspects of it, but didn't really understand the immensity, in a certain sense, of the changes that were going on until later, looking back on it. America's Most Wanted is a good example of that. I mean, we had, when we were, before we went underground, we were very much both working in solidarity with prison struggles and also had undertaken some analysis of how the law and order movement, as we framed it at the time, was really trying to develop a popular base, mainly among white people, for support for the police, for turning in other people, for sort of just basically organizing communities in alliance with the police and law enforcement rather than in, you know, alliance with each other. And so we had done some of that analysis prior to going underground. So, but then when we began watching, I mean, we had a very immediate and personal interest in America's Most Wanted because we were very worried that our story was going to be featured, which it eventually was, and that was definitely jeopardize us and our security. So we were very attentive, let's say, to the program. But we also tried to understand it in a more general socio-political sense. And it was really pretty horrifying because, and you know, I think it's hard to kind of paint the picture of what it looked like now when reality TV and crime TV is so mainstreamed and everyday, and people, I mean, may not like it, but they, you know, it's not it's not innovative at all. But this was at the time innovative. I mean, it's important to understand that this was not the type of programming that had been happening before, where you really, you kind of involve people directly through these TV program with catching criminals, so-called. I mean, today it would be catching, or it is catching terrorists. So to us, that was a big development politically. And I think that what we, I mean, that was a right assessment, that it really was a big deal, a shift. I mean, and now it's become all-encompassing in terms of the degree to which programs like that are just assimilated into the media and everyone's consciousness of how people are caught. So that was one very big signifier in terms of a shift around criminalization and massification of law and order ideology. At the same time, we were aware that this the so-called the drug war was escalating, that there were all these connections to, I mean, everyone was aware of the Iran-Contra scandal and the ways in which the war in Nicaragua, I mean, I shouldn't say everyone, but there was a political awareness on the left of the way in which the Contras were being used to actually funnel drugs into Black communities. And so we could see, and then at the same time, as the laws were getting more and more draconian in terms of the ways in which people with drugs were being prosecuted. So we could see those types of changes and note them. But I don't think it wasn't really until the mid-90s where sort of the full extent of the impact of the shift in drug laws became more evident, and that we were really began to understand, along with a lot of other people, progressive people, how much this was not, it had kind of qualitatively changed to a situation where instead of just targeting leaders or leading organizations, which was how COINTELPRO operated, that now there was this whole prison industrial complex structure that was targeting entire communities of color for internment, and that all of that was really a response to the level of revolutionary and activity that had occurred, and the threat which the U.S. state saw in the activities of the Panthers and the AIM and the Puerto Rican independence movement, so that they had to develop a more comprehensive strategy in order to contain that potential for upsetting the racist status quo.
So I feel like there's a few shifts that you're mentioning here, and I'm curious if and how much they factored into you and your comrades' decision to resurface in the mid-90s. So you're talking about this law and order shift that's sort of characterized through shows like America's Most Wanted. And then there's also this shift in terms of the drug war and policies around imprisonment in the U.S. that are imprisoning more and more people and, in fact, like targeting whole communities. Did watching those two shifts happen and recognizing how much they were solidifying impact your decision to resurface in 1996?
Yes, in certain ways. Although I wouldn't say that was the main factor. It was like in combination. I think the problem, or what we recognized, was that the most of the forces that we had gone underground in solidarity with had been devastated mainly by COINTELPRO and related imprisonment strategies over the time that we were after we had gone underground, and that we were there no longer were other forces that we could really work with in what we considered a good political way. And our own situation was so precarious that we really spent most of our time concentrating on not getting caught, which is really a terrible thing as a political activist to dedicate your life to. But, I mean, we didn't want to get caught, and that's for different reasons, because we saw that most of the people, and we had been, comrades with many of the people who ended up as political prisoners, Alan Berkman, David Gilbert, Laura Whitehorn, Linda Evans, Marilyn Buck. I mean, there's a lot of other white anti-imperialists who ended up in prison and had, like, decades-long sentences. So we didn't want to, that didn't seem like a good outcome for what we were about. So So we did take a lot of care in many different ways, as much as we could, not to get caught, even though we did also figure out ways to try and act on a certain progressive political level, because we were all political people and we didn't want to just be spending our lives, you know, worrying about security. We didn't want to get caught, and yet we didn't see a long-term path, political path, for us underground. Of course, personally, it was terrible also, but we really did not see how to change the structure of our lives given what the political realities were. And so we did investigate, and finally we were able to figure out how to return in a way that was principled. I mean, that was the big problem with, the unknown factor is that we thought, which some groups at the time didn't think was right, although actually there was a shift by the time we came back to public life, you know, that there shouldn't ever be any type of deal with the police or the state. But we felt like that was too rigid a definition, because right as we were living, we were not accomplishing anything. So, but we really were adamant and that we would not be complicit in giving information or cooperating or anything like that. So we needed to come up with some type of a negotiation that meant that we wouldn't have to cooperate. And amazingly, and it is pretty amazing looking back at it, we were able to do that. And, you know, there are probably many different reasons that that was true. I mean, a couple of people from our collective had to do time, and that was part of the deal. But it was a much more limited than many other people had to do, and we were able to return. So yeah, it was mainly the desire to continue being political activists that was motivating in our return.
So when you and your comrades returned in the mid-90s, two people in your group were sentenced to not so many, but a few years in prison on charges of supporting an escape attempt for Puerto Rican political prisoner Oscar Lopez Rivera. I'm wondering if your ideas about prison and prisoner solidarity changed once you had a more personal connection to people inside, and or did you feel like you had more personal connections to folks inside at this time?
Yes. So, yes, we were two members of our group, my partner, Claude Mark, and my very good friend and comrade, Donna Wilmot, were both convicted, or they were, they didn't have a trial, but by the terms of our negotiation, they were sentenced to a certain number of years. Claude served 4 and Donna served 2. And yeah, having them in prison absolutely transformed my relationship to prisons in general. I mean, as I had talked about, I had visits before. We were very aware of prisoners inside, but, you know, having a member of your family, and in my case, the father of my 2 kids, was very life-changing on an emotional, psychological level, and also in terms of the insights that it gave me into the prison system as a whole, the way it is operated with family members, the way family members are treated sort of as an extension of the prisoner, and are intimidated, harassed, humiliated on a regular basis in relationship to their loved ones. I think in terms of my ideas about prisoner support, I mean, I began to see it on a multi-dimensional, multi-leveled way. And at that point, I think there were different influences, but I really began to feel like you couldn't separate political prisoners from everyone else who was in prison. I mean, there were differences, and I know an ongoing debate, but I believe that people who, you know, consciously make political choices, that then they end up being put in prison as a result of those political choices and those political actions, there's a distinction in terms of who they are. And also people who then become radicalized in prison and then suffer consequences because of their radical positions and actions once they are in prison. And, you know, it's not a hierarchy. It's not like these are better people or exactly. I just think that the importance to movement supporting people who are actively fighting. There's also an importance for movement supporting people who are targeted because of primarily their race, their economic stature, their gender, and end up in prison because of all those political factors. And that is the connection that I began to see at the time was really critical to make. And I think only now is it really becoming a connection that is more generally made. I feel like for years there was a real separation between the parts of the political movement in the U.S. anyway, I don't know how it is in Canada, that did solidarity work with political prisoners and the parts of the movement that were working against the prison industrial complex and in solidarity with prisoners who did not come into the prison system because of their political consciousness or activity. And yet they really are, in my mind, in my experience, very closely linked, and I think they're very much have to be tackled together. So I feel like now that those connections are beginning to be made, they've been made by various groups from time to time, but in a more wide-scale way, was really excited for many, many reasons, but the vision for Black Lives that just came out, the policy platform that was released by the Movement for Black Lives really does make some of those connections in a really important way.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We're in the middle of airing an interview from our archives. It is a 2016 interview we did with Diana Block. Diana is the author of two books, a memoir called Arm the Spirit, and a novel called Clandestine Occupations. She is part of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, an organization dedicated to organizing with and advocacy for former and current prisoners in the women's prison system in California. In this section, Diana talks about how the language around political prisoner support has changed since the 1980s, and also talks about a delegation she was a part of to visit political prisoners in Palestine. Diana mentions a lot of political prisoners throughout this interview, and since it was recorded in 2016, we wanted to mention that some of the people she knew have since been released. Oscar Lopez Rivera was released in 2017, Jaleel Muntakim was released in 2020, and David Gilbert was released in 2021.
So you touched on some things from my next question in your last answer, which is great. And you were talking about how discourse around like the prison industrial complex and debates about political prisoners versus quote unquote non-political prisoners have played out. And so I'm wondering if if there's any other things that you've noticed in terms of like discourse around supporting political prisoners and prisoners of war that has changed since the 80s and 90s. And if so, what those changes might be. And then how has your relationship to political prisoners changed? And in addition to Oscar, are there any other folks who you support now whose stories you'd also like to share with the Prison Radio Show?
Yeah, well, some of it I've talked about in terms of supporting, the political prisoners has changed. I mean, but partly I didn't talk about how, at least at this point in time, I feel like there is much more awareness of political prisoners than there was, certainly in the 80s, when people, 70s and 80s, when people were just kind of being wholesale arrested off of COINTELPRO. But also in the 90s, when people were really invisible for the most part. I mean, and either were seen as terrorists or were just not known at all. And there have been many factors which have changed that awareness, primarily both the combined activity of the prisoners themselves with forces on the outside who have been incredibly nonstop committed to raising consciousness and freeing those prisoners. I mean, Mumia stands out. I know there are people who don't know Mumia's name, but in terms of progressive circles, people know who Mumia is, a large part of the population, and that has to do with both, of course, Mumia's brilliance, his steadfastness, his continuous writing and radio work, and then all the people on the outside who have supported him for all these years. And that, the movement for Mumia's freedom was really just starting when I came back to public life. And I remember being just amazed because Mumia had been in prison then for 13, 14 years already. But very, very few people knew who he was. And then in the mid-90s, there was a burst of activity from many different groups and people and getting his own words and writing out. And that shifted the landscape, and people began to know who Mumia was. And, you know, I'm not going to go into the whole history, which other people can do much better than I could anyway. But I think Mumia and his case really opened up doors for people understanding some of the other prisoners, not just in and of itself, but because then people made connections. And the same thing with Leonard Peltier, who is also someone who is really very well, much more well-known now than it used to be. So, and then another thing I did want to mention was the development or the founding of the Jericho Movement, which I was part of in 1998, which was a kind of inspiration, a joint inspiration by Jaleel Muntakim, who has been in prison since the 70s, and Safia Bukhari, who had been a political prisoner but had gotten out. And the two of them really developed this idea together of really trying to put together a formation that didn't deal with just the individual political prisoners in the United States, but really linked them to each other and tried to cross nationalities and areas of the country and political affiliations. Began to say, these are all political prisoners. They are targeted because of the way in which they were fighting for liberation of their people, and we have to get them out in the joint. It was a joint strategy, and that was the brilliant concept of the Jericho Movement at its founding. And I think the existence of that movement has also really helped to popularize the existence of political prisoners, or the, in terms of letting people know about them and making allowing people to draw connections between different political prisoners. In terms of people I, you know, support now, there are various people. I mean, one thing I do want to mention, because I have really mainly been talking about men who are in prison, political prisoners. Most of the women who I did visit for many years, Laura Whitehorn, Linda Evans, Susan Rosenberg, were able to be released and are no longer in prison. Marilyn Buck, whom I also visited, was released at the very end of her life and then unfortunately, very sadly, died within 18 days of her release. So those are people who definitely are women who were very important politically to me, but they are no longer in prison. And most of the people that I am most in touch with now are men. I just visited both David Gilbert and Jaleel Muntakim in June.
You've written about being part of a prisoner solidarity delegation to Palestine. Could you tell us a bit about how that came about?
Yeah, this is something that I really am right now very committed to, is trying to really support the development of solidarity between prisoner movements, between prisoners and prison movements in different places. And Palestine is some place where prisoners and the movement to support prisoners has always been very central in the Palestinian struggle. I mean, partly because of the huge number of people who have been imprisoned in that country by the Israeli state, the method of totally crushing the liberation struggle. So the way this particular delegation, or some of the roots, were that one of the leading methods the Palestinian prisoners have used to try to win both changes in prison conditions as well as the changes in prison policies has been the hunger strike. And, you know, a hunger strike is a last resort, but it's something that prisoners can engage in both individually and collectively. And dating back to the 60s and the 70s, Palestinian prisoners engaged in hunger strikes, often with successfully in terms of actually being able to win demands. Not always, and sometimes people have died, but it has been used very effectively. So in 2013, when prisoners in the Pelican Bay SHU, solitary confinement, were embarking on their second, or maybe it was their third hunger strike in just a few years. And there, the point of their hunger strike was to end long-term solitary confinement. Some of them had been in prison for decades. So they were planning this hunger strike, and those of us on the outside who were working in solidarity with them really wanted to in some way link their struggles with Palestinian struggles, which were at the time also there was a whole hunger strike being engaged in Palestine. We were able to make some connections and solidarity statements from one of the most steadfast hunger strikers was sent to the prisoners just at the beginning of their hunger strike, and that was really inspiring for them. After that, and that hunger strike actually did end with a significant victory and changes in the policies in the state of California, which was really great. But a number of us were very interested in trying to push forward that relationship or that interconnection. Part of it is about just creating forms of solidarity between prisoners and inspiration across borders. Part of it is also, you know, trying to draw the link between the repressive state apparatuses that operate in conjunction with each other, namely Israel and the United States, and the ways in which they have developed these prison complexes and torture methods and all sorts of similar forms of repressive techniques together. And that's something that we felt that the movement, well, certainly the movement in this country needs to understand the relationship. I think the movement in Palestine does understand that relationship better than we have in the past, although that is now changing. So we went, we were able to go part of a delegation hosted by a professor from San Francisco State, Rabab Abdulhadi, and we were able to include several former political prisoners, a radicalized former prisoner, and the rest of us were prison activists, anti-prison activists. So it was the first time that the delegation focused on prison solidarity had actually been brought together from the U.S. And it was really an amazing experience for countless reasons. One of the really important things to me was just meeting so many people who were former prisoners who were now totally active and engaged in the struggle for liberation, and just learning or hearing their stories and what their commitments are now like, and as well as their experiences in prison and how they were able to resist torture and interrogation and humiliation, and for the women, sexual abuse and all sorts of terrible things. And that those lessons of resistance, I think, are something that we really felt like were really important to bring back to the United States and share.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We wanted to share this message from the Certain Days Calendar Collective. The Certain Days Collective will be releasing our 22nd calendar come this autumn. In lieu of a 2023 theme, we are doing an open call for abolition-related art and article submissions to feature in the calendar, which hangs in more than 6,000 homes, workplaces, prison cells, and community spaces around the world. We encourage contributors to submit both new and existing work. We especially seek submissions from people in prison or jail, so please forward this call to any prison-based artists and writers. The deadline for submission is Friday, June 14th, 2022. You can submit articles that are 400 to 500 words maximum. Poetry is welcome, but needs to be significantly shorter than 400 words to accommodate layout. Please include a suggested title. You can also submit art. The calendar is 11 inches tall by 8.5 inches wide, so art with a portrait orientation is preferred. Art need not fit these dimensions exactly. The collective is interested in a diversity of media, and the calendar is printed in color, and they prefer color images. Send your submissions by June 14th, 2022 to info@certaindays.org. Prisoner submissions are due July 1st, 2022, and they can be mailed to Certain Days, care of Burning Books, 420 Connecticut Street, Buffalo, New York, 14213. You've been listening to an interview from our archives. This is Diana Block, and it was recorded in 2016. In the last section of the interview, Diana talks about her work with the California Coalition for Women Prisoners.
You've been involved in the California Coalition for Women Prisoners since its inception. Do you want to talk a bit about how the group got started, but also focus more on what you all are working on now?
Well, the group got started at a point when women had become, in the United States, had become the fastest growing sector of the prison population. And that was in the context of a prison population which was absolutely skyrocketing in the mid-90s. And within that, women were the fastest growing sector. And of course, when we're talking about women, it's mainly primarily women of color, black women who have like 8 times the imprisonment rate of white women and Latina women. And so I'm dating back to my first political awakening, I've always identified as a feminist. I've always wanted to be doing some types of work that are supporting liberation for women on terms that are not about, you know, more equality with the status quo. Not to say that there aren't many aspects of equality that I certainly support, but seeing liberation for women as more of a transformative, revolutionary process rather than trying to get more within the current structure of capitalist society. So when I began understanding that women were, in fact, one of the fastest growing sectors of the prison population, and that this was totally an issue of racial injustice as well as gender injustice, it was something that I felt like I wanted to really work on. And over time, we have really, we've expanded our definition, though not our name per se, in terms of our work is also with transgender prisoners in the women's prisons. We still are mainly focused on the women's prisons in California. We do a lot of different types of work, but I think some of the things that have both been consistent and are also on the forefront of our agenda right now have always been support for women who are survivors of domestic violence and then who responded to the domestic violence in one way or another, and that ended up in prison. And often doing life sentences with no possibility of getting out. So we do a lot of advocacy around trying to get people out and trying to, you know, understand what was wrong with their trial, what, you know, different using legislative means, public awareness building, lots of different things. We're also working right now around the conditions inside the women's prisons, which have all led to a literal epidemic of suicide that is occurring. And, you know, I think, you know, trying to understand that if people hear suicide and, well, that's the person's fault or they choose to commit suicide. But in fact, the way we understand the whole situation is that the conditions have deteriorated to such a point, and the way in which the state and the guards and the whole structure is coming down on the people in these prisons, they see no option besides suicide. And this is really just a very, very dramatic expose of the degree to which these are horror camps. So we are really trying to bring public attention to this issue. We've actually gotten a lot of media because the situation is so bad. There's now finally going to be some type of an audit of the prisons. But we do work a lot with trying to limit or expose the types of, you know, really genocidal conditions in the prison, as well as trying to get people out. So we do have a website, which is womenprisoners.org. And we also organize a lot of people. I mean, we go and we visit in the prisons every month. And we are constantly recruiting new volunteers and training them. And I think that's one of our big contributions, is that we actually are an organization that for 20 years has visited the women's prisons consistently and has a real presence and is trusted by people inside and is able to bring others into that knowledge is very, very important in terms of changing public awareness and enabling people to then go back to their communities and organize against prisons. I mean, we don't see our work in isolation at all from work for, around all prisons. We just prioritize in the work of our visiting and our legal advocacy the women's prisons in California. And we also, that's I should say, we also have produced a newsletter that is for 20 years called The Fire Inside, and that is consists of a lot of the writings and poetry and various artwork from people inside, as well as sort of people, you know, we work with people who are formerly incarcerated, as well as advocates and supporters, and so we collectively produce a newsletter that tries to cover the main issues of what's happening not only in the women's prisons, but in the prisons in general. And I think that is another one of our big accomplishments, is that we have been able to produce this for 20 years, and that it, you know, it's read by people around the country, around the U.S., as well as the people in the women's prisons.
That was the final part of our archival interview with Diana Block. We recorded the interview in 2016, but it was shortened to re-air today. In particular, we cut a long section where Diana talked about the fight to free political prisoners and Puerto Rican liberationist Oscar Lopez Rivera. Oscar was liberated in 2017 when then-President Obama commuted his sentence. Most of the political prisoners mentioned by Diana in this interview have been released, except for Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu-Jamal, who are both still fighting for their release. You can check out past episodes of The Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and prisonradioshow.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. Parts of our show are also available through podcasting apps. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 p.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on June 24th, that's a Friday, at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us. Our email address is prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. People can also call us collect. We're at 514-876-3748. You can call that number collect from Bordeaux or RDP prisons. If you don't need to call Collect, we have a different number we encourage you to try. It is 438-337-8423. Again, you can call us Collect from Bordeaux or RDP prisons at 514-876-3748. Or if you don't need to call Collect, we're available through a regular phone line at 438-337-8423. Keep in mind, we are an all-volunteer collective. It is difficult for people to get to the phone, so if you don't get through, keep trying, and hopefully you'll reach someone eventually. People in prison can write to us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Virginia, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
Walk with us. on Saturday, June 11th at 1 p.m. Join us for the 8th Annual Spirit Walk on beautiful Mount Royal. The Spirit Walk is an annual fundraiser for the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal, Poyipo Tham. Register to walk and set a personal goal to fundraise for the shelter. All funds go directly to the Native Women's Shelter of Montreal towards their second stage housing project and Saradikitak Social Pediatric Clinic. Join us for fun, community-driven, even including musical performances generously supported by CKUT. Everyone is welcome. Bring your friends, family, and pets, and come walk with us. Follow our Instagram at SpiritWalkMTL for links to register and for more information.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Chochage and Ganiagaha, and Munayang and Anishinaabe, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah De A, recording not from home, not for the first time in over 2 years, but recording from Fringe Park at Parc des Amériques, corner of Saint-Laurent, the Main, and Rachel. Outdoors here bring you a very special edition of Upstage, the Fringe edition. On tonight's show, coming to you from Fringe Park, just a day before the official opening, we're going to speak with the artists behind five shows coming to the Fringe: Adam and Eve, Cornichon with Nisha Coleman, Sire, a father-daughter vampire story, The Walk in the Snow with Jem Rolls, and Would Virginia Woolf Contemplate on Suicide if She Were Filipino? I'm so glad you can join us. I'm here with part of the Fringe crew. They're busy setting up the park, getting ready for about 10 days worth of live outdoor shows and events. I'm here with some of the wonderful people from the CKUT crew, including Jack, Olivia, and Chloe. And I'm here with my very first guests. Welcome, Marissa Blair and Jeroen Lindemann.